Blog Talk Radio.
Today, so I should be very well rested up and ready to go. I'm hoping each and every one of your days this week has been productive, if nothing else. And if you did find yourself in some pickles, I'm quite sure you found a way to get out. As you know, this is Black History Month, which I believe every month should be Black History Month, because it should be something we'll be teaching our children every day. What they're not getting at school, we should be making sure they're getting it at home, instilling them and keeping them with the knowledge of their history. As you know, and I don't know if anybody watched CNN yesterday, I think it happened yesterday, about some of the situations that are happening here in Louisiana when it comes to race relations. Sometimes you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And some people really let their real true feelings out. And sometimes it can end up, it can be the result of something very serious. So we have to be very, very careful on how we say things. That's including myself. And to sometime guard our tongue. Getting into tonight's show, we're talking about, we're going to start off this segment with slavery in the United States. A lot of this information I got from Wikipedia and thomaspaine.org. I'm going to try to read some of this. It was a essay that was written by Mr. Thomas Paine. I'm going to try to get to it tonight. Also, I want to start out tonight's segment with a song by the OJs. And it so happened I discovered it by accident. I didn't know it existed until I heard it again, then I realized I knew this song. So I'm going to play this song for you first before we get into slavery in the United States. Sorry, started from the
beginning.
And if anyone wants to call in, I apologize, I didn't mention my number. It's 1-347-677-1749.
Ship ahoy, 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 ship ahoy
All right, that was a song called Ship Ahoy by the OJs, which was interrupted by another song by the OJs, and I apologize for that. Okay, tonight we're talking about slavery in the United States. Slavery in the United States lasted as a legal institution until the passage of the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution in 1865. It had its origins with the first English colonization of North America in Virginia in 1607, although African slaves were brought to Spanish Florida as early as the 1560s, most slaves were black and were held by whites, although some Native Americans and free blacks also held slaves. There was a small number of white slaves as well. Slaves were spread to the areas where there was good quantity soil for large plantations of high-value cash crops, such as cotton, sugar, and coffee. The majority of slaveholders were in the southern United States, where most slaves were engaged in an efficient machine-like gang system of agriculture, with farms of 15 or more slaves proven to be far more productive than farms without slaves. Also, these large groups of slaves were thought to work more efficiently if guarded by a managerial class called overseers, to ensure that the slaves did not waste a second of a moment. According to 1654 until 1865, slavery for life was legal within the boundaries of much of the present United States. Before the widespread establishment of chattel slavery, which is the outright ownership of the slave, much labor was organized under a system of bonded labor known as indentured servitude. This typically lasted for several years for the white and black alike, and it was a means of using labor to pay the cost of transporting people to the colonies. By the 18th century, courts' ruling established the racial bias basis of the American incarnation of slavery to apply chiefly to black Africans. And because of the success of, and people of African descent, and occasionally to Native Americans, in part because of the success of tobacco as a cash crop in the southern colonies, its labor-intensive character caused planters to import more slaves for labor by the end of 17th century than did the northern colonies. The South had a significantly high number and proportion of slaves in the population. 12 million Africans were shipped to the Americas from 16th to the 19th centuries. Of these, an estimated 645,000 were brought to what is now the United States. The largest numbers were shipped to Brazil. The slave population in the United States had grown to 4 million by the 1860 census. The war, slavery was abolished throughout the United States with the adoption of the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution. Okay. Colonial America, saying that a main article, slavery in colonial United States, the first record of African slavery in colonial America was made in 1619. A British pirate ship under the Dutch flag, the White Lion, had captured 20 Angolan slaves in a battle with the Portuguese ship, the Sao João Batista, bound for Veracruz, Mexico. The Angolans, were from the Kingdom of Dongo and Congo, and spoke languages of the Bantu group. The White Lion had been damaged first by the battle and then more severely in a great storm during the late summer when it came ashore at Old Point Comfort, site of present-day Fort Monroe in Virginia. Though the colony was in the middle of a period later known as the Great Migration, which was from 1618 to 1623, during which its population grew from 450 to 4,000 residents, extremely high mortality rates from disease, malnutrition, and war with Native Americans kept the population of able-bodied laborers low. Americans kept the population, with the Dutch ship being in severe need of repairs and supplies and the colonists being in need of able-bodied workers, the human cargo was traded for food and services. In addition to African slaves, European, mostly Irish, Scottish, English, and Germans were brought over substantial numbers as indentured servants, particularly in the British 13 colonies. Over half of the white immigrants to the English colonies of North America during the 17th and 18th centuries might have been indentured servants. In the 18th century, numerous Europeans traveled to the colonies as redemptioners. The white citizens of Virginia who had arrived from Britain decided to treat the first Africans in Virginia as indentured servants. As with European indentured servants, the Africans were freed after a stated period and given the use of land and supplies by their former owners. Anthony Johnson, a former indentured slave from Africa, became a landowner of the Eastern Shore and a slave owner. The major problem with indentured servants was that in time they would be freed, but they were unlikely to become prosperous. The best lands in the tidewater regions were already in the hands of wealthy plantation families by 1650, and the former servants became an underclass. Bacon's Rebellion showed that the poor laborers and farmers could prove a dangerous element to the wealthy landowners. By switching to pure chattel slavery, new white laborers and small farmers were mostly limited to those who could afford to immigrate and support themselves. In addition, improving economic conditions in England meant that fewer laborers wanted to migrate to the colonies as indentured servants, so the planters needed to find new sources of labor. The transformation from indentured servitude to racial slavery happened gradually. There were no laws regarding slavery early in Virginia's history. However, by 1640, the Virginia courts had sentenced at least one black servant to slavery. In 1654, John Kesser, a black man, became the first legally recognized slave in the present United States. A court in Northampton County ruled against Kesser, declaring him property for life, owned by the black colonist Anthony Johnson, since persons with African origins were not English citizens by birth. They were not necessarily covered by English common law. Elizabeth Key Grinstead successfully gained her freedom in the Virginia courts in 1656 by making her case as the baptized Christian daughter of a free Englishman, Thomas Key. Shortly after Elizabeth Key trial in 1662, Virginia passed a law on partus, stating that any children of an enslaved mother would follow her status and automatically be slaves, no matter if their father was a free-born Englishman. This institutionalized the power relationship and confined the possible scandal of mixed-race children to within the slave quarters. The Virginia Slave Codes of 1705 further defined as slaves those people imported from nations that were not Christian, as well as Native Americans who were sold to colonists by other Native Americans. In 1735, the trustees of the colony of Georgia passed a law to prohibit slavery, which was then legal in the 12 other colonies. It was meant to eliminate the risk of slave rebellions and make Georgia better able to defend against attacks from the Spanish to the south. It also supported the vision of Georgia's original charter to turn some of England's poor into hardworking small farmers. The Protestant Scottish Highlanders who settled what is now Darien, Georgia, added a moral anti-slavery argument, which was rare at the time. In their 1739 petition of the inhabitants of New Inverness, it is shocking to human nature that any race of mankind in their prosperity should be sentenced to perpetual slavery, nor in justice can we think otherwise of it, that they are thrown amongst us to be our scourge one day or other for our sins. And as freedom must be as dear to them as it is to us, what a scene of horror must it bring about? And longer it is unexecuted, the bloody scene must be greater. But there was a popular support for slavery and skillful lobbying by the colonists. In 1750, slavery again became legal in Georgia. During the British colonial period, slavery existed in all the colonies. People enslaved in the North typically worked as house servants, artisans, laborers, and craftsmen, with the greater number in cities early on. Slaves in the South worked primarily in agriculture on farms and plantations, growing indigo, rice, tobacco. Cotton became a major crop after 1790s. The tobacco was very labor-intensive, as was rice cultivation. In South Carolina in 1720, about 65% of the population consisted of slaves. Slaves were used by rich farmers and plantation owners who cultivated crops of commercial export operations. Backwoods subsistence farmers, a later wave of settlers, seldom owned slaves. Some of the British colonies attempted to abolish the international slave trade, fearing that the importation of new Africans would be disruptive. Virginia bills to that effect were vetoed by the British Privy Council. Rhode Island forbade the import of slaves in 1774. All of the colonies except Georgia had banned or limited the African slave trade by 1786. Georgia did so in 1798, although some of these laws were later repealed. The British West Africa Squadron slave trade suppression activities were assisted by forces from the United States Navy, starting in 1820 with the USS Scion. Initially, this consisted of a few ships. With the Webster-Ashburton Treaty of 1842, the relationship was formalized, and they jointly ran the African squadron. 1776 to 1850. Second Middle Passage. The growing demand for cotton led many plantation owners west in search for more suitable land. It was for this reason that slavery did not spread to the north, instead spreading west. Historian Peter Colchin wrote, "By breaking up existing families and forcing slaves to relocate far from everyone and everything they knew, this migration replicated, if on a reduced level, many of the horrors of the Atlantic slave trade." Historian in Berlin called the forced migration the Second Middle Passage, characterizing it as the central event in the life of a slave between American Revolution and the Civil War. Berlin wrote that whether they were uprooted themselves or simply lived in fear that they or their families would be involuntarily moved, the massive deportation traumatized black people, both slave and free. Although complete statistics are lacking, it is estimated that 1 million slaves moved west from the Old South between 1790 and 1860. Most of the slaves were moved from Maryland, Virginia, and the Carolinas. Originally, the points of destination were Kentucky and Tennessee, but after 1810, the states of the Deep South, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas, received the most. This corresponded to the massive expansion of cotton cultivation in that region, which needed labor. In the 1830s, almost 300,000 were transported, with Alabama and Mississippi receiving 100,000 each. Every decade between 1860, 1810, and 1860 had at least 100,000 slaves moved from their state of origin. In the final decade before the Civil War, 250,000 were moved. Michael Tandeman, in 1989 book Speculators and Slaves, Masters, Traders, and Slaves in the Old South, indicate that 60 to 70% of interregional migrations were the result of the sale of slaves. In 1820, a child in the Upper South had a 30% chance of being sold south by 1860. Slave traders were responsible for the majority of the slaves that moved west. Only minority moved with their families and existing owners. Slave traders had little interest in purchasing or transporting intact slave families, although in the interest of creating a self-reproducing labor force, equal numbers of men and women were transported, Berlin wrote. The internal slave trade became the largest enterprise in the South outside of plantation itself, and probably the most advanced in its employment of modern transportation, finance, and publicity. The slave trade industry developed its own unique language with the terms such as prime hands, bucks, breeding wenches, and fancy girls coming into common use. The expansion of the interstate slave trade contributed to the economic revival of once depressed seaborne states. As demand accelerated, the value of the slaves who were subject to be sold. Some traders moved their channels by sea, with Norfolk to New Orleans being the most common route. But most slaves were forced to walk. Regular migration routes were established and were served by a network of slave pens, yards, and warehouses needed as temporary housing for the slaves. As the trek advanced, some slaves were sold and new ones purchased, Berlin concluded, and all the slave trade with its hubs and regional centers, its spurs and circuits reached into every cranny of Southern society. Few Southerners, black or white, were untouched. The death rate of slaves on the way to their new destination across the American South was much less than that of the captives across the Atlantic Ocean. Mortality was still higher than the normal death rate. Berlin summarizes the experience. The second Middle Passage was extraordinarily lonely, debilitating, and dispiriting, capturing the mournful character of one southward marching couple. An observer characterized it as a procession of men, women, and children resembling that of a funeral. Indeed, with men and women dying on the march or being sold and resold, slaves became not merely commodified, but cut off from nearly every human attachment. Murder and mayhem made the second Middle Passage almost as dangerous for traders as it was for the slaves, which were why the men were chained tightly and guarded closely. The coffles that marched slaves southward, like slave ships that carried their ancestors westward, became mobile fortresses, and under such circumstances, flight was more common than revolt. Slaves found it easier and far less perilous to slip into the night and follow the North Star to the fabled land of freedom than to confront their heavily armed overlords. Once the trip was ended, slaves faced a life on the frontier significantly different from their experiences back east. Clearing trees and starting crops on virgin fields was harsh and backbreaking work. A combination of inadequate nutrition, bad water, and exhaustion from both the journey and the work weakened the newly arrived slaves and produced casualties. The preferred location of new plantations at rivers' edges with mosquitoes and other environmental challenges threatened the survival of slaves. They had acquired only limited immunities in their previous homes. The death rate was such that in the first few years of hewing a plantation out of the wilderness, some planters preferred, whenever possible, to use rented slaves rather than their own. The harsh conditions on the frontier increased slaves' resistance and led to much more reliance on violence by the owners and overseers. Many of the slaves were new to cotton fields and unaccustomed to the sunrise to sunset gang labor required by their new life. Slaves were driven much harder than when they were involved in growing tobacco or wheat back east. Slaves also had less time and opportunity to improve the quality of their lives by raising their own livestock or tending vegetable gardens for either their own consumption or trade as they could in the eastern South. In Louisiana, it was sugar rather than cotton that was the main crop. Between 1810 and 1830, the number of slaves increased from 10,000 to over 42,000. New Orleans became nationally important as a slave port, and by the 1840s had the largest slave market in the country. Dealing with sugarcane was even more physically demanding than growing cotton. Planters preferred young males who represented two-thirds of the slave purchases. The largely young, unmarried male slave force made the reliance on violence by the owners especially savage. Now, let's talk about the treatment of slaves. Without the power to punish, which the state conferred upon the master, bondage could not have existed. By comparison, all other techniques of control were of secondary importance. That was by historian Kenneth M. Stamp. Stamp further notes that while rewards sometimes led slaves to perform adequately, most agreed with an Arkansas slaveholder who wrote, "Now I speak what I know when I say it is like casting pearls before swine. To try to persuade a Negro to work, he must be made to work and should always be given to understand that if he fails to perform his duties, he will be punished for it." According to both the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Bryan Davis, the historian Eugene Genovese, treatment of slaves were both harsh and inhumane. Whether laboring or walking about in the public, people living as slaves were regulated by legally authorized violence. David makes the point that while some aspects of slavery took on a welfare capitalist look, yet we must never forget that these same welfare capitalist plantations in the Deep South were essentially ruled by terror. Even the most kindly and humane masters knew that only the threat of violence could force gangs of field hands to work from dawn to dusk with a discipline, as one contemporary observer put it. Of a regular trained army, frequent public flogging reminded every slave of the penalty of inefficient labor, disorderly conduct, or refusal to accept the authority of a superior. Slaves that worked and lived on plantations were commonly punished. This punishment could come from the plantation owner or master. His wife, children, white males, and most often by the overseers. Slaves were punished with a variety of objects and instruments. Some of these included whips, placed in chains and shackles, various contraptions such as metal collars, being hanged, and even forced to walk a treadmill. Those who inflicted pain upon the slaves also used weapons such as knives, guns, field tools, and objects found nearby. The whip was the most common form of punishment performed on a slave. One slave said that the only punishment that I ever heard or knew of being administered to slaves were whipping. Although he knew several that had been beaten to death for offenses such as sassing a white person, hitting another Negro, fussing or fighting in their quarters. Slave overseers were authorized to whip and brutalize non-compliant slaves, according to an account by a plantation overseer to a visitor. Some Negroes are determined never to let a white man whip them and will resist you when you attempt it. Of course, you must kill them in that case. A former slave describes his witness to females being whipped. They usually screamed and prayed, though a few never made a sound. If the women were pregnant, they were often dug a hole for them to place their bellies in while being whipped. After many of the slaves were whipped, they would further torment the slaves by bursting the blisters and rubbing them in turpentine and red pepper. Other incidents reported that after being beaten, they took a brick, grind it up in a powder, mix it with lard, and rub it all over them. Metal collars were also commonly used so that the slave would be reminded of his wrongdoings. Many collars were thick and heavy. They would often have spikes protruding, hassling the slave while doing field work and preventing them from sleeping lying down. Lewis Kane, a former slave, describes his witness to another slave being punished. One nigger run to the woods to be a jungle nigger, but massa caught him with the dog and took a hot iron and brands him. Then he put a bell on him and a wooden frame was slipped over the shoulders and under his arms. He made that nigger wear the bell a year and took it off on Christmas for a present to him. He sure didn't make good nigger out of him. Plantation owners would sometimes hang slaves because the slave was causing more trouble than he was worth, or the owner didn't deem them valuable anymore. Slaves were punished for a variety of reasons. Most of the time it's for working too slow, breaking a law such as running away, leaving the plantation without permission, or not following orders given to them. Myers and Massey describe the extent of many punishers. The punishment of a deviant slave was decentralized, based on plantations, and crafted so as not to impede their value as laborers. Laws made to punish the whites for punishing their slaves were often weakly enforced or could be easily avoided. An example being in the case Smith versus Hancock. Here, the defendant was justified in punishing his slave with physical abuse because he showed the courts that the slave was attending an unlawful meeting discussing rebellion, that he refused to surrender and resisted the arresting officer by force. Whites often punished slaves in front of others to make an example out of them. A man named Harding described an incident where a woman assisted several men in a small rebellion. The women he hoisted up by the thumbs, whipped and slashed her with knives before the other slaves till she died. Men and women were sometimes punished differently than the other sex, according to the 1789 report of the Committee of the Privy Council. Males were often shackled, and women and girls were left freely to go about. By law, slave owners could be fined for not punishing recapturing runaway slaves. Slave codes authorized, indemnified, or even required the use of violence were denounced by abolitionists for their brutality. Both slaves and free blacks were regulated by the Black Code and their movements monitored by slave patrols conscripted from the white population, which were allowed to use summary punishment against escapees, sometimes maiming or killing them. In addition to physical abuse and murder, slaves were at constant risk of losing members of their families if their owners decided to trade them for profit, punishment, or to pay debts. A few slaves retaliated by murdering owners and overseers, burning barns, killing horses, or staging work slowdowns. Stamp, without contesting Genovese assertions concerning that the violence and sexual exploitation faced by slaves, does question the inappropriateness of a Marxism approach in analyzing the owner-slave relationship. Genovese claimed that because the slaves were legal property of their owners, it was not unusual for enslaved black women to be raped by their owners, members of their owners' families, or their owners' friends. Children who resulted from slave rapes were slaves as well because they took the status of their mothers, unless freed by the slaveholder. Neil Irvin Painter and other historians have also documented that Southern history went across the color line. Contemporary accounts of Mary Chestnut and Fanny Kemble, both married in the planter class, as well as accounts by former slaves gathered under the Works Progress Administration, all attested to the abuse of women slaves by white men in the owning and overseeing class. However, the Nobel economist Robert Fogel conversely described as a myth the belief that slave breeding and sexual exploitation destroyed black families. He argues that the family was the basic unit of social organization under slavery, and to the economic interests of the slave owners to encourage the stability of slave families, then most of them did so. Most slave sales were either of whole families or of individuals at an age when it would have been normal for them to leave the family. However, eyewitness testimony from former slaves does not support Fogel's view. Frederick Douglass, who grew up as a slave in Maryland, reported the systematic separation of slave families and widespread rape of slave women to boost slave numbers. In early 1930s, members of a federal Writers Project interviewed former slaves, and doing so produced the only known original recordings of former slaves. In 2007, the interview were remastered and reproduced on modern CDs and in the book form in conjunction with the Library of Congress Smithsonian Productions and the National Radio Project in the book CD Oral History Projected project called Remembering Slavery, African American Talk About Their Personal Experience of Slavery and Emancipation. The editor wrote, as masters applied their stamp to the domestic life of a slave quarter, slaves struggled to maintain the integrity of their families. Slaveholders had no legal obligation to respect the sanctity of a slave's marriage bed and slave women. Married or single, had no formal protection against their owners' sexual advances. Without legal protection and subject to the master's whim, the slave family was always at risk. Some slave women were used for breeding more slaves. Plantation owners would have intimate relations with female slaves in order to produce more slaves. Some slaves were even forced to have sex with others to increase population and increase the amount of slave product on the market. The book includes examples of enslaved families torn apart when family members were sold out of state, and it contains examples of sexual violations of the enslaved people by individuals who held power over them. Very interesting. and I say that because this stuff is very interesting. I want to not keep reading all that, and we can always go back to that. I want to read this essay by Thomas Paine. Two Americans. Some desperate wretches should be willing to steal and enslave men by violence and murder for gain is rather lamentable than strange. But that many civilized may Christianize people should approve and be concerned in the savage practice is surprising and still persists. Though it has been so often proved contrary to the light of nature, to every principle of justice and humanity, and even good policy, by a succession of eminent men and several late publications. Our trader in men, most known the wickedness of slave trade, if they attend to reasoning or the dictates of their own hearts, and such as shun and stifle all these willfully sacrifice conscience and the character of integrity, to that golden isle. The managers, the trade themselves, and others testify that many of these African nations inhabit fertile countries, are industrious farmers, enjoy plenty, and live quietly, averse to war, before the Europeans debauch them with liquors and bribing them against one another, and that these inoffensive people are brought into slavery by stealing them, tempting kings to sell subjects which they had no right to do, and hiring one tribe to war against another in order to catch prisoners. By such wicked and inhuman ways, the English are said to enslave towards 100,000 yearly, of which they thousands are supposed to die by barbaric treatment in the first year, besides all that are slain in the unnatural ways excited to them to take them. Excuse me, I'm sorry, you guys, I'm having a hard time reading. So much innocent blood have the managers and supporters of this inhuman trade to answer for to the common law lord of all. Many of these were not prisoners of war and redeemed from savage conquerors, as some plead, and they who were such prisoners, the English who promote the war for that very end, are the guilty authors of their being so. And if they were redeemed, as it alleged, they would owe nothing to the Redeemer but what he paid for them. They show as little reason as conscience who put the matter by saying, men, in some cases, are lawfully made slaves, and why may not these? So men, in some cases, are lawfully put to death, deprived of their goods without their consent. May any man therefore be treated so, without any conviction of desert. Nor is this plea mended by adding, they are set forth to us as slaves, and we buy them without further inquiry. Let the sellers see to it. Such men may as well join a known band of robbers by their ill-got goods and help on the trade. Ignorance is no more pleadable in one case than the other. The sellers plainly own how they obtain them, but none can lawfully buy without evidence that they are not concurring with men stealers. And as the true owner has a right to reclaim his goods that were stolen and sold, so the slave who is proper also proper owner of his freedom has a right to reclaim it, however often sold. So we see that slavery was a big economic boost for the United States. The labor was free, opposed to a room and board. We saw that slavery also divided families, even though some people were in denial of it, but a lot of families were divided. We learned that there were different tribes that were manipulated by the white man into fighting against each other. They were used to go after slaves that ran away. So they learned to teach us how to fight against each other, tell on each other. I mean, it's amazing how we were treated. And I say we because I'm talking about my ancestors. I can say this. I'm not really familiar with my family tree, but I can truly say that my mom was born here in Louisiana, and she can tell me some stories about how they used to work in the cotton fields. She wasn't an indentured slave, but they were sharecroppers. They had to work the cotton fields. I mean, even though they said sugarcane was the biggest thing in Louisiana, my mom worked on a cotton field. She worked in the cotton fields with her brothers and sisters and her mother and father. Now, I do know my grandfather, there was an opportunity for him to work on the railroad, and he worked on the railroad also. My grandmother cleaned houses and worked in people's kitchens. So that form of slavery was there too. And they were what you called indentured slaves, in a sense, because they were paid to do what they were doing. Now, I know that my grandmother was owned, I don't want to say owned, but raised by Irish people. So that already gave me the perception that probably her mom and dad gave her away to these Irish people to be housekeeper or to be the maid. I mean, that's what the assumption I get. And I will find out more from my mom. How did my grandmother wind up in the house of Irish people? Now, my grandmother does have Irish in her. So somewhere somebody owned something. The Irish people had a lot to do with slavery too. I look at the different colors and textures of our people. There is a melting pot, and as you saw, I read, where the slave owners literally came and slept in the bed with the slaves, with the women slaves. They used them to breed, to make more stronger workers or slaves. So they would lay down with them, and they would have kids. Now, I do remember somebody saying that most of the light-skinned slaves worked inside the house, and the dark-skinned slaves seemed to tough it out and can last in the field. So when we talk about black history, this is where our history starts, right here with slavery. I will say this, that I'm hoping that you guys could understand what I read, okay? And next week, we'll talk more about this, but I want to go into something different because I know we only have 4 weeks in February for slavery. So I'm going to probably touch a little bit more on this next week, but we're going to go into something different. We're going to move on to the freedom of slaves. From this point on, we'll talk about the freedom of slaves. I will summarize this next week. If you guys have any questions, you know you can catch me or
get in contact with me on Blog Talk Radio, or you can write me on chocolatebun59@hotmail.com or sensible64@yahoo.com. You also can check out my YouTube videos. I'm under CMBS44. I have a couple of commentations that I put on there also. But I also would like to get some help with some people. It's called The Voice of Change, and it's also on my YouTube channel, and I'm hoping to start launching some commentaries on that channel probably either in the end part of February or the very beginning of March. And I'm going to be using that YouTube to kind of gear back to my Blog Talk Radio channel. Show. So I'm going to stop here, 3 minutes out, and I'm going to say thank you guys for listening, and I hope next week we can get together again and we can kind of summarize slavery in the United States, and then we'll talk about more about when freedom of slavery happened and when it took place, what year. And I also want to go over some numbers when it comes to the population of slavery. What state had the most slavery by the end of, I think it was 1780? And I'll touch a little bit on that. Then we'll go forward to the next segment, which is going to be freedom of slavery. Freedom of slavery. Okay? So you guys have a nice night. Love you. See you back next week. God bless. And remember to love, live, laugh in all the same order. Bye.